Hello, I'm Bene Nauden, and this is The Process. As a kid, my guidance counselor at school had me do a profession survey to determine what I might want to do in life. I remember reading through the options and selecting a good number of them. In fact, I picked so many professions that my counselor did not quite know what to make of me. I wanted to do so many things, and I still do. I would say a good number of people don't really know what they want to do in life. Sure, there are some who do, and plan and shape their destiny walking a very defined path. But many people haven't a clue. They think they want to do something, and then they realize they don't. Or something changes, and they decide to go in another direction. Sometimes they might pick up a skill or do something as a hobby without really giving it any thought. And then that skill sets them apart, makes them stand out, and leads them on a professional path they did not expect. Then, there are those whose world is turned upside down by war or persecution, and any plans they may have had are dashed, and they must flee their homes for someplace safer, sometimes stagnating for months or years in limbo. If and when they arrive to a new country, they often must forge a new path in life, learn a new language, new skills, often shedding their former selves to shape their new identity. With any luck, they are shepherded through the initial discombobulation and culture shock by welcoming and caring organizations and individuals who help them get settled into their new lives and continue to provide assistance as needed. My guest today is Chris George, the executive director of a refugee resettlement agency in New Haven called IRIS, whose mission is to help refugees and immigrants establish new lives, regain hope, and contribute to the vitality of Connecticut's communities. Since I myself have been interested in working with refugees, I was curious to know how he got into this field. So, here goes nothing. Today I'm here with the executive director of IRIS, Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services, Chris George. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I'm very curious about your journey to where you are now. And I wanted to find out who you were when you were a young man and where you're from. And just some background about you before you started going into the field of immigration and refugee services.
Sure. So I was born in Waterloo, Iowa, December 1953. And a few years later, the family moved to New Jersey. And I really grew up in New Jersey, Montclair, New Jersey, and had, I guess what you call kind of a typical American middle-class childhood. I was a Boy Scout, went to public schools. Montclair decided to integrate its schools in 1966. So I was bused from my part of town to another part of town in order for the schools to be integrated. It was probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Can you tell me a little bit about this? How did that go? And were you aware of what was going on at the time?
I think I was aware, partly because my father was a journalist. He was an editor for ABC Radio News. So I was probably more aware of what was going on in the world, including the civil rights stories, than the average kid. But busing was very controversial, and many white parents pulled their white kids out of the public school system when the decision was made by the Board of Education, you know, in 1965, 66, to bus. My parents, of course, kept us in, and it was really a great experience. And Montclair, to this day, is one of the more integrated public school systems in the country. The best education I had. But it was controversial, and I remember going to a Board of Education meeting, and parents were pretty angry and were pulling out all kinds of reasons why they didn't want their kids to ride on a bus. They wanted the kids to come home for lunch every day. Can you believe that we actually did that back in 1965? They thought buses were too dangerous. You know, I don't want my kids spending all this time on a bus. And, you know, of course, the real reason was they were racist. And, you know, I think a lot about that experience nowadays, that it was a very good experience for me to go through and the other white kids to go through back then. It has prepared us maybe a little better for this really revolution that's going on now in this country.
So did you feel that it was integrated to the core in terms of friendships and things like that?
Yeah, because, you know, when you go to school with kids beginning in the sixth grade, and the integration began, the busing for desegregation began for me in the sixth grade. You go 6, 7, 8, and then you go to high school, 9, 10, 11, 12, and sure, you make friends with kids of all colors. And I still in touch with some of them on Facebook. It was really a great experience. And Montclair High was very well integrated. And I played lacrosse. I did other things that kids growing up in New Jersey did. And actually was a pretty good lacrosse player on a very good team. And that allowed me to go to a really good college, which is the University of Pennsylvania.
At 18, when you were starting out in college, what were your goals in life? What did you aspire to become?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I think if you had asked me then, I would have said, I want to become an archaeologist. Because I had spent the summer between my junior and senior year on an archaeological excavation in Winchester, England. I took advantage of this program. It was called Eurojobs, Jobs in Europe, and went to England for the summer and worked on a dig and loved it. It was just, you know, terrific to be outdoors in the sun and the dirt. You know, digging is to some extent glorified playing in the dirt, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And decided to study archaeology at the University of Pennsylvania, and they had a very strong program in archaeology. I figured I was pretty much on track to become an archaeologist.
Did you get a bachelor's degree in archaeology, or did you change midway?
I shifted from archaeology first to cultural anthropology because it was a little more interesting, and then to history. So I did not get a degree in anthropology or archaeology. When I applied to Peace Corps, and maybe I'm getting a little ahead of myself with your questions, but I'll just mention it now because it's relevant. When I applied to Peace Corps in 1976. There were positions in the Department of Archaeology in the Sultanate of Oman that they wanted to fill with Peace Corps volunteers.
Oh.
So on my application, the archaeology experience just jumped out. And I was, the term I think the Peace Corps used back then was pre-slotted. I was pre-slotted for archaeology, for a job in the Department of Archaeology in the Ministry of Culture in the Sultanate of Oman. And that was my Peace Corps job. I was an archaeologist for 2 years.
So did you apply to Peace Corps right after college, or did you work a little bit?
No, I applied pretty much right after college. I graduated a bit late in 77 instead of 76. I took an extra semester. Graduated in spring of 77, and then I was off to Peace Corps, I think, October of 77.
So you're one of the young Peace Corps volunteers. So you were in your 20s and really kind of fresh and green. So how was that experience for you? I mean, obviously, you were working in a field that you knew a little bit about. But how was the sort of cultural changes, you know, the shock of entry into a place like Oman?
Well, I had had a couple of overseas experiences under my belt before that. I mentioned one, worked in Winchester, England for a summer. I also took a semester off from college and worked on a kibbutz in Israel in 1974. So I'd done some traveling, some living for, you know, a relatively long period of time, 2 months, 4 months overseas. So it wasn't a, you know, total shock. And my older sister, Tanya, was a Peace Corps volunteer in Tunisia. She probably more than anyone else got me interested in Peace Corps. She'd had a great experience in Tunisia. She really talked it up. And that's what led me to apply. But yeah, Oman was a tough place. I'd done a lot of camping, when I was a Boy Scout in New Jersey, and I sometimes felt that Peace Corps was like a 2-year camping trip. You pack accordingly, you're living in a place that doesn't have electricity or running water. It took some getting used to. It was really hot. I mean, really hot. It's the kind of hot you feel when you open up the oven door to check on something that you're baking. But I was in a small group. Our group was only about 8 people, and we got to know each other well. Of course, you know, like most Peace Corps volunteers, when you arrive, I was whisked off to a sleepy little fishing village where no one spoke any English, and that's where we did our language and cross-cultural training.
And so what language were you learning?
It was Arabic. And, I started from scratch. Didn't know a word of Arabic when I started. And we studied Arabic 6 days a week, about 7 hours a day, for about 2.5 months. That's how long the training program lasted and gave us a good foundation.
And what was your, you said you were going into archaeology there. What was your task? What was your mission there? What were you supposed to do?
Right. So I did a variety of things in the Department of Antiquities. A lot of it was recording archaeologically significant sites in Oman before they were, you know, plowed over, destroyed, for new buildings and roads. So driving around and photographing old buildings and remains. I also managed a couple of excavations and, you know, managed a team of people digging through the layers of the soil, recording everything as you go, taking pictures and drawing cross sections, collecting pottery, cleaning the pottery, writing numbers on the pottery. A lot of it is kind of, you know, mundane, maybe even boring, laborious work. Not as romantic and exciting as I imagined it would be. And that's why after 2 years of doing it in Oman, I decided, you know, I'm not so sure I want to be an archaeologist for the rest of my life.
It wasn't as exciting as the movies show it to be, the action movies.
No. Yeah, I didn't carry a bullwhip and a six shooter and, you know, wear that
cowboy hat.
The cowboy hat or the fedora, whatever it was that that Indiana Jones wore. You know, it wasn't quite like that. But it, and, you know, the outdoor part was great. But unfortunately, most of archaeology is indoor work and studying and research and you know, looking at broken pieces of pottery.
And you were more interested in getting out and seeing people and things and digging and finding.
Doing things with people, interacting with human beings instead of rocks and dirt and soil and, you know, having discussions about, you know, helping a family get a job instead of arguing with other archaeologists about how to represent a layer of sand in a cross-sectional drawing.
So tell me about your experiences with the locals, because you were working obviously with locals on the digs and on in the office and in whatever museums that you might have been going to, you know, helping out with and or departments. But did you live with a family? What was that situation? What were your interactions with regular local people?
We worked with Omanis in the department, and I also worked with a lot of Omani workers in on the excavations. We lived by ourselves. The culture society of Oman is not one that lends itself to home hospitality. You know, some places around the world, Peace Corps volunteer will live with a family. You can't do that in Oman.
Okay.
The culture society just doesn't allow a single man to kind of come in and live with a family. So we all lived together, we being other Peace Corps volunteers. In fact, there were four that worked in the Department of Antiquities when I was there. And we all lived together and we commuted together to and from work, took turns cooking and, you know, made great friends with those guys. Jim, David, Kelly, we all lived together and got along really well. After a year, I decided, you know, I think I want to marry my sweetheart, who I had left behind in Philadelphia to join Peace Corps. We'd been sending letters, you know, almost daily, and every now and then a phone call. I'd go to the post office and book a phone call and wait 20 minutes. And then I was assigned to a booth and I picked up a phone and I had, you know, 5 minutes to talk to her on the phone. And in the course of those communications, we decided, you know, let's meet in Greece after I've been in Peace Corps for a year, decide if we're going to get married. If we get married, then we'll go back to Oman together and I'll finish out my term.
Uh-huh.
And we did get married. We were married in Cyprus in 1978, the middle of my Peace Corps stint.
Wow.
And her name was Liz Webb. And Liz and I went back to Oman and she worked in the Department of Antiquities with me.
Uh-huh.
So Peace Corps showed great flexibility and understanding by, you know, allowing that to happen.
So she did that on her own, not as part of Peace Corps, though.
That's right. We call her an honorary Peace Corps volunteer, but no, she was not a Peace Corps volunteer. She just kind of came on her own. Oman was very strict about single women coming into the country, so she basically had to marry me to get in.
Yes.
And then we moved into our own house, a place called El Bustan, just outside of Muscat, and it was a wonderful time.
So you had a young married life in Oman, and you decided you didn't want to be an archaeologist. So what happened after you were done with Peace Corps?
Well, Liz and I moved back to Philadelphia, and you know, I had an experience that I bet a lot of Peace Corps volunteers have had over the years. I had what I thought was an incredible experience that should put my resume at the top of every job application pile.
But it doesn't.
Yeah, in fact, I designed a really cool resume because no one knew where the Sultanate of Oman was. I had a little map insert of the Middle East showing where Oman was on my resume. A little hand-drawn map. And I was not able to find anything in what I considered to be a pretty broad field of anything international, even in a place like Philadelphia. So I had to pick up short-term jobs like substitute teaching in the Philadelphia public school system. And then also I worked as a plumber's assistant for a while in Philadelphia.
Wow, that sounds cool.
Yeah. I did a couple of Peace Corps training programs each summer. So summer of 80 and summer of 81.
And what do you mean by training programs?
Well, I helped train new volunteers who were going out to Oman at a training program in Colorado. And then I actually went back to Oman in 81 for about 3 months. And I helped train new volunteers who had arrived in Oman.
How was that going back after being back in the States for a while?
Oh, it was terrific to go back. I mean, I loved Oman and it was a lot of fun, and I could see some friends again. And the training program was also, it's intense but enjoyable, and I realized that, I do like training and I like teaching, and I was able to help with the Arabic and also the cross-cultural training.
Mm-hmm.
So that was terrific. So that was, 81, still not finding anything, long-term. And then in 1982, while I was doing some plumbing, I applied to the American Friends Service Committee for a job in Lebanon to do some reconstruction work after the war. And they were really intrigued to see a combination of plumbing and Arabic.
Uh-huh.
And they said, we want this guy. Leave it to the Quakers. And I went to Lebanon for a couple of years and worked there doing a lot of reconstruction work in South Lebanon. And then that led to a job with Save the Children, 9 years with Save the Children, mostly in the Middle East.
And what were you doing with Save the Children?
They sent me to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And I ran the program in the Gaza Strip, and then also ran the program in the West Bank and Gaza.
And when you talk about running the program, what was the program?
Well, we did a lot of things in West Bank, Gaza. Everything from building kindergartens to starting a small loan program for farmers, building agricultural roads, constructing huge oxidation pools for sewage, running water lines, all kinds of infrastructure and social services. It was a really big program funded by USAID.
Uh-huh. You were the director of the program, so you oversaw everything, and how big was the staff? And
Yeah, oversaw a staff of about 20, 25 people, mostly Palestinian, some expatriates, some Americans, and it's a program that just got bigger and bigger, especially after the Oslo Accords were signed much later. And it did a lot of good. The U.S. government, instead of implementing their own programs, would fund the programs of voluntary organizations like Save the Children.
And you say you were there for how many years?
I was there for 5 and then came back to their headquarters, Save the Children's headquarters, and worked 4 years there as a kind of acting director for Middle East programs. So while I was in that position, I went to Afghanistan and Pakistan, to Egypt, actually went to Somalia also to set up an emergency program there. Did a lot of traveling when I was with SAVE.
Mm-hmm. And your Arabic, I mean, you had learned Arabic in Oman, and each country speaks a little differently. How was that communicating in Arabic in all these different countries?
Well, I have to say, Omani Arabic is at the far end of the Arabic spectrum. And then at the opposite end is Lebanese Arabic. So I went from Oman to Lebanon, and the people in Lebanon laughed at me when they heard me speak. I'm sure it sounded a little bit like a cross between a hillbilly and Shakespeare. It was a very, you know, Omani Arabic is very, considered very kind of quaint, compared to, you know, North African Arabic and Lebanese Arabic. Pronunciation sounds very rough and probably grates on the ears of Lebanese. But, I adjusted and later developed a pretty good, Palestinian Arabic working in West Bank and Gaza.
Mm-hmm. So along with these experiences, your wife joined you, and was she working as well?
She did. She did join me. She was tough. We had a one-year-old, and Liz and our one-year-old Susanna went to the Gaza Strip with me. Liz did not go with me to Lebanon. We were apart for that period. But we got back together again, had a child, and then, yep, we spent all 5 years in West Bank Gaza together, had another child born in Palestine, Rosalind. So we had Susanna and Rosalind, and then eventually came back to Connecticut to work at Save the Children headquarters, and then had a third child, Logan.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually went back again. So, you know, spent some time in Connecticut, but the attraction of the field was just the field work was just too strong. So I accepted a job back in the West Bank and Gaza Strip after the Oslo Accords were signed, when everyone was feeling very optimistic about a peace process between Israel and Palestine. And my job then, this was 1996, was to help the newly elected Palestinian parliament, to help them turn into a strong legislative body.
What kind of things were you helping them with? That seems very complicated and complex.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, it was a USAID democracy program and, you know, legislative strengthening. We brought in consultants from all over the world who helped the Palestinian parliament set up their departments, draft good laws, organize public hearings, figure out the best way to represent their constituents, how to conduct oversight of the executive branch. And that was a big issue because, of course, the executive branch was Yasser Arafat. And he did not have much interest in a strong legislature.
Uh-huh.
Basically wanted to do things on his own. So there was a real tug of war between the parliament and the executive branch, and we were there helping them figure out ways to assert their strength. It was a very exciting time.
And was it very volatile over there?
Well, it was relatively peaceful for the first 4 or 5 years, but then the last 3 years we were there, from 2000 to 2003, It became dangerous. The second uprising, or the second intifada, started. There was a lot of violence. There were suicide bombings. There were snipers. There were demonstrations and, you know, firebombs, and yeah, it was rough.
So how did that affect your work? How did you navigate that with all that happening?
At times there were curfews. At times there were travel restrictions for Americans. So very interesting. I learned how to work remotely way back in 2001, 2002, working in Palestine. And it's something that we're doing now because of COVID. Working remotely was really a way of life back then in West Bank and Gaza, because you never knew when there was going to be a curfew, when things were going to be closed down, when the road would be too dangerous to travel, or if the U.S. government said, sorry, you cannot go to your office in Ramallah for the next, you know, month.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was, you know, you carried your laptop with you wherever you went. You made sure you had connectivity, you know, at your home. And, you know, we didn't have Zoom back then, but we had you know, a lot of applications that allowed us to stay in touch. At one point, it got so dangerous, our two daughters had to go. We sent them to a school in Europe, and eventually...
How old were they at that time?
You know, they were sophomore in high school and senior in high school.
Okay, so they were older and able to cope with the change a little bit better than if they had been younger.
Yeah, and my wife, Liz, was in medical school there. Medical school in Beersheba. There was an Israeli program affiliated with Columbia University. So she completed her medical school and then chose to do residency in Middletown, Connecticut. So in 2004, we came back to Connecticut, and we've been here ever since.
So you stayed with Save the Children for a while in Connecticut.
Well, the democracy work that I was doing back in West Bank, Gaza, was with an international consultancy group called Associates in Rural Development, ARD. So I left Save, did a 2-year stint at Human Rights Watch, Middle East, in New York, and then after Human Rights Watch, went back overseas on that democracy program. So
let's pause for a second here. You're bopping around from one thing to the next. Do people seek you out, or did you apply for these positions?
You know, after 9 years of working with Save the Children, I was ready for a change, and I was drifting at Save the Children. I was seemed to be moving more toward human rights work and, you know, away from sort of the basic needs, was interested in advocacy. So I found the position at Human Rights Watch, applied for it, and yes, and I got that. But then I learned, you know, they do terrific work, a lot like Amnesty International, very valuable. It's got to be done, but editing and writing human rights reports is not my cup of tea. I'd rather be working with people out in the field, and that's what took me back to the Middle East. And then coming back 8 years later to Connecticut again, the search was on for something international, but based in the United States. We needed to stay here for a while. And again, it wasn't easy. And I came upon a job announcement for an executive director for a refugee resettlement agency based in New Haven. And I'd never heard of refugee resettlement. No one had ever heard of this organization. It was called Interfaith Refugee Ministry at the time. And did a little bit of research, applied for the job, and was fortunate to get it in May of 2005. And I've been here ever since.
So this changed and became Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services?
Right. When the board hired me, they had just come out of a strategic planning process, which concluded that the organization needed to diversify, and it needed to diversify in every way. It needed to reach out and work with a more diverse group of people, needed to change its name in order to reflect a more inclusive attitude. So instead of Interfaith Refugee Ministry, we changed the name to IRIS, Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. Instead of working almost exclusively with churches, we reached out. We were working with synagogues and mosques and secular groups. Instead of depending almost entirely on government funding, we needed to diversify our funding and raise a lot of private funds. Instead of just, you know, working with the staff, we need to reach out and recruit thousands of volunteers. And we did all that, and it's been very successful.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the journey of the refugee. How does it work? Who are these people? I mean, obviously, we've seen a lot of footage more recently about refugees trying to get into safety. But some refugees have been in camps for so long.
Right.
You know, what kind of situation is out there?
Right. Well, I had spent some time in refugee camps during those overseas jobs that I had, especially with Save the Children. Save the Children had projects in refugee camps in Pakistan, in Somalia, in West Bank Gaza, Lebanon. So I spent a lot of time visiting refugee camps, mostly in the Middle East over the years. So I knew that end of it. I knew the overseas part of it. I had a pretty good feel for, and then also working at Human Rights Watch, I had a pretty good feel for the story of the persecution and the flight from their countries to other countries and living in you know, miserable conditions in refugee camps. But I did not know much about the resettlement program that the U.S. government runs. And in fact, most Americans don't know much about it. And you know, Binay, that's one of the big problems. You can't expect Americans to support something they don't know anything about. I mean, it's fundamental, right? But when Americans do know about the U.S. government refugee resettlement program, that every year the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security interview people overseas and run them through the most rigorous vetting process in the world and then invite them to come to the United States and don't give them a ton of money so they can sit around for years. No, they require them to get a job as soon as possible and to hit the ground running. And, you know, eventually it's a slog, but eventually they make it. That is this country's oldest and most noble tradition. It's symbolized by the Statue of Liberty. It is really one of the best things this country does. And when Americans know about that, and if they have worked as volunteers helping refugees, showing them how to shop in the local grocery store or registering kids in school or tutoring high school kids or helping somebody get a job, if they've done that and have, you know, been intimately involved in welcoming and resettling refugees, they overwhelmingly support refugee resettlement. And that's what we need more of. We need more engagement in this work. And that's what we've tried to do here at IRIS, is get as many people as possible involved in working with our staff or on their own after they've been trained to get to know refugees.
So how do you do that? How do you get people involved, and what kind of involvement can happen?
You know, it's really remarkable, Binay. So many of our volunteers come to us asking how they can help. They take the initiative. We do not have to go out and do big volunteer fairs. We don't have to set up a card table in the middle of New Haven Green during a band concert and, you know, hawk our organization and encourage people. People will hear about us, they'll read an article about us, they will be outraged by what they hear or see come out of Washington, and they'll say to themselves, I've got to do something. I want to support immigrants. I want to support refugees. How can I do that? They'll jump on their computer, they'll search the internet, and they'll find that there is a refugee resettlement agency in New Haven, and they jump on our website, and we'll go to the volunteer section, and then they're here. So we make a point of using as many volunteers as we can. And I'm always urging other directors of refugee resettlement agencies, you know, you've got to have a strong volunteer program, because it's true. The services that we give to refugees, and, you know, that includes housing and connecting them to healthcare and helping them learn English, helping them find a job, enrolling kids in school, those services are really important. But just as important is educating Americans about refugees and engaging them in the resettlement process, because that's what builds public support. And that public support will translate to political support when you need it. and come election time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we want elected officials to believe in this refugee program as much as we do. And, you know, the U.S. historically has invited more refugees to the United States than all of the other countries put together with refugee programs.
Wow.
That has changed under the recent, under the current administration. In fact, numbers have plummeted under the current administration.
And I understand that there are more changes that our Department of Homeland Security are trying to propose that will change things even further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, picture our immigration system as a wall that is just filled with doors and windows. And through those different doors and windows, immigrants come, refugees come. The current administration is trying to slam shut all of those openings, all of those doors, one way or another, closing down asylum requests at the southern border, shutting down the refugee resettlement program, drastically reducing the asylum possibilities for people who are seeking asylum. So, you know, every effort to push immigrants out of this country or shut the doors to immigration, every effort has been made by the current administration.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about refugee versus asylum seeker. Can you just go over the vocabulary a little bit?
Sure. Sure. So the international law definition of a refugee is a person who was forced to flee his or her home country because they've suffered persecution, or they have a well-founded fear of persecution. Persecution because of their race, their religion, their nationality, a particular social group that they're in, or their political opinion. And there are 26 million people who meet that definition. 26 million refugees in the world today.
Wow.
Now, an asylum seeker is someone who is seeking refugee status. So asylee, refugee, are basically synonymous. The only difference is where they're granted that status. If someone who's fled persecution in their home country is granted refugee status overseas, they're called refugees. If they come to the United States, let's say on a tourist or a student visa, and they apply for refugee status here in the United States, we call that seeking asylum.
Uh-huh.
And once they're granted asylum, they're called an asylee. It is essentially the same as refugee status. So asylum seeker is, you can think of them as one step away from having refugee status.
Mm-hmm.
The million or so people fleeing Middle East and Africa, crossing the Mediterranean in 2016, 2017, they were technically seeking asylum because they had not been granted refugee status just yet by anyone, not by the UN and not by the countries that they had arrived at. Germany allowed a million of them into their country, and one by one, their cases were being adjudicated. Some were granted refugee status and allowed to stay. Some were not and had to go back.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, here in the United States, we have a program run by the State Department that brings an average of about 70,000 refugees who've been selected, vetted overseas, assigned refugee status, and then they're brought to the United States to be resettled. We also allow people, regardless of how they enter the country, to apply for asylum.
So you say that they're vetted. How does this process, does it begin? So if they're coming from abroad, they're coming from some kind of camp or?
Yeah, often they live in a camp. Not, you know, despite what most people think, the majority of refugees actually do not live in formal refugee camps. They'll find other places to live. You know, it might be urban slums, but they're not refugee camps. UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, people will register with the UN and they will apply for resettlement.
Mm-hmm.
But only a tiny fraction of the world's refugees are even considered for resettlement.
Right. So they have to go through a whole application process, and it takes up to 2 years.
That's true, because the Department of Homeland Security runs a security screening. The CIA and the FBI are involved. Several interviews. The information is run through terrorist watch lists and international criminal databases. If in the course of an interview, somebody says something that doesn't sound right or is inconsistent, they could be kicked out of the process and just not allowed in. So it's a very tough and grueling process.
Yes, it sounds like it. So when they get here, they're like pretty wrung out, and you welcome them with open arms.
We do.
And
that was pre-COVID open arms.
Well, okay, pre-COVID.
Now we keep our distance.
Right. So now we'll get to that in a second. So technically, the process is that they would be vetted, and they arrive in the U.S. and they're accompanied or they're welcomed by a U.N. official.
Right. They're met at the airport, mm-hmm, by the U.N. And you know, in our case, if they're coming here, they land in JFK, they're met, and someone puts them on a minivan shuttle, and then, you know, they zip up 95 and they arrive in New Haven. And then my case manager, sometimes the last two families who've arrived, I've actually been there to greet them. And if we need an interpreter, we have an interpreter, and we take them to their apartment. They get settled. They eat a culturally appropriate hot meal that's been cooked by, in most cases, someone from their home country, someone who's already here. That's a federal requirement, Vinay, that within 2 hours of a refugee's arrival, they have served a culturally appropriate hot meal.
Interesting.
And, you know, they have a good night's sleep in the apartment that's been, you know, very nicely set up. And then the next day they come in and we sit down with them and go over the program. And, you know, it has to be done pretty quickly. Enroll the kids in school, connect them to healthcare, help them learn English, help them find jobs.
Yes.
You know, boom, 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 boom. And then we get ready for the next family.
You talked to me at one point about community-based.
Right.
So tell me a little bit more about, because you can't handle everybody that comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And you also want people to have the opportunity to be in different locations and to have the communities of different locations welcome people.
Right. So long before the voluntary organizations and the nonprofits like mine got heavily involved in refugee resettlement, refugees were welcomed by friends and relatives, and in some cases community groups. It was a very informal kind of ad hoc system. Since the early 80s, refugee resettlement has been professionalized. Nonprofits like mine, experienced professional case managers, employment coordinators, we've been doing the work of resettling refugees, my staff, sometimes with some volunteers helping out. But there is another way, and it is really based on the old-fashioned way, and that is with community groups of volunteers coming together saying, hey, to an organization like mine, hey, Iris, tell us what to do, train us, and supervise us, but please place a refugee family with us in our community. We want a refugee family in, you know, Bloomfield or Hartford or in Fairfield or Middletown or Brantford. Give us a refugee family. We'll do all of the things that your staff does. And on top of that, we'll be their friends. And, you know, we'll show them how to rake leaves and shovel snow and how to, you know, deal with dogs on leashes and all of these things that, you know, brand new Americans need to learn. It is the best way to resettle refugees. And not only do these community groups provide excellent services, and of course they've been trained by us, they're supervised by us, not only do they provide excellent services for refugees, but in the process they learn about refugees and they become committed to supporting refugee resettlement. They also learn a lot about themselves and our own country, and, you know, it's just an amazing experience for these volunteers. We do a lot of that model here, more than any other refugee resettlement agency.
we entrust volunteers to resettle refugees, to an extent that no other refugee agency does. We give almost all of the responsibilities to these groups of volunteers. And, you know, when you give a lot of responsibility to a group of volunteers, they get much more satisfaction out of it. And they do a great job. So we're trying to promote this community-based model across the country. And we're having some success. But, you know, when you approach a professional organization that is used to doing something a certain way for decades, there can be some resistance.
Yeah.
But we believe that this is the future of refugee resettlement, is to get thousands and thousands of community volunteers involved.
So tell me, how many agencies are there in Connecticut, and where are they located?
Well, there are three refugee resettlement agencies. One is dormant now, and not receiving new arrivals. That's Catholic Charities in Hartford.
Okay.
Again, because the current administration has drastically reduced the number of refugees coming into the United States.
Right.
Some refugee programs had to shut down.
Yes.
The other two are IRIS, mine, based in New Haven, and then another one called the Connecticut Immigrant and Refugee Institute, CIRI. That's based in Bridgeport.
Uh-huh. And you all function a little differently, but the services you provide are very similar.
Yes. CIRI has a large legal aid program, larger than ours. We also do legal aid. But we're the largest refugee resettlement agency in Connecticut now, by far. And we are the only one that uses this community-based approach.
Mm-hmm. So since you mentioned earlier a little bit about COVID-19, that obviously has compounded things in terms of slowing things. Can you tell me a little bit about how you're operating now?
Right. So we've been working remotely for 4 months, and that means all of the staff are working from home. We're still providing services to refugees and immigrants. We're doing it remotely.
What kind of services are you helping them with currently?
Well, you know, helping them apply for unemployment assistance, helping them apply for jobs. I'm now in the back parking lot behind my office, and I am looking at employment coordinator help to refugees from Afghanistan apply for a job at Amazon. She's under a tent in case it rains, but we're outdoors because of the COVID threat. She's wearing a mask. They're wearing masks. They're sitting in front of a large screen monitor, and she is keeping her distance, helping them get through the training process for the Amazon job. So that's a service that we continue to offer. Case managers are still instructing people how to get food stamps and cash assistance, helping them solve problems with their utilities, helping them pay their rent. You know, if you arrived in March as through the refugee program, let's say from Afghanistan, you probably weren't here long enough to get a job. You're not going to be eligible for unemployment assistance if you didn't have a job that you lost. So we've been helping a lot of families pay their rent. And fortunately, the people of Connecticut have stepped forward and have increased their donations to us. So we've had private funds to help people pay their rent. And if you're an undocumented immigrant, you're not eligible for any government services at all. You're not eligible for health care. You're not eligible for food stamps. You can't get cash assistance. And, of course, if you lost your job as a undocumented immigrant, you're not eligible for unemployment benefits. So we've been helping a large number of undocumented immigrants pay their rent, so they're not evicted. We also run a food pantry. In fact, we run it right here in the back parking lot where I'm sitting now doing this interview. This morning, Wednesday morning, 140 families sent people to our office to pick up 2 bags of groceries. So our food pantry has almost tripled in size. We've gone from about 75 families a week to helping now about 220 families
mm-hmm.
a week.
Mm-hmm. So you still continue your services and you still help a lot of people. It's sort of hard to see the future these days. So
it is. It really is. It's very difficult to figure out what's going to happen. We're in this for the long haul. We plan to be running a grab-and-go style food pantry where people come in, grab the bags from the back door and go. They don't need to come into the office. We plan to be running this and expanding it, you know, for the next year. We plan to raise funds so that we can help people pay their rent, you know, for the next year. We will continue to figure out ways to provide services to clients. And if we have to, you know, set up a larger space outdoors so that we can do it safely, you know, we will. It takes a lot of creativity and problem solving. These are skills that Peace Corps volunteers develop really well working overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And I often think back to my years as a Peace Corps volunteer and how it was great training for this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really grateful that I had that experience.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to talk about your annual Run for Refugees, which is a fundraising event.
Yes, been going on for 14 years. Bigger and bigger every year. We started, I think, with about 360 participants, and we were over 2,000 this past year. So it has grown enormously. It's a lot of fun, and I hate to say this, Binay, but I am afraid we're going to have to do it very differently in February of 2021.
Uh-huh.
I think we're not going to get through this pandemic, and I think we're not going to be able to bring 2,000 people together in two large gymnasiums of the local high school, let alone pack them together at the starting line and have them run in a large group 5 kilometers.
Yeah, so it might not happen next year.
Well, we'll do something. I guarantee you, we'll do something. There are some road races that have figured out a way to do a virtual run. But, you know, people don't think of football on Super Bowl Sunday anymore. They think of, oh, that's the day that Irish peasants run for refugees. We have replaced the Super Bowl on the calendar. So we owe it to our supporters to do something that Super Bowl Sunday morning. And we will.
Great. Do you have any sort of parting words or any closing comments that you would like to share? We have listeners who really are from all walks of life. And do you have any recommendations if somebody wants to get involved or if you want to explain something that we haven't talked about?
Well, that's a good question. If anyone who is listening to this is the least bit interested in learning more about refugee resettlement or perhaps volunteering to help refugees and immigrants, then please jump on our website, www.irisct.org, IRISCT for Connecticut.org. And you'll see a lot of information there, all sorts of options for helping out. You know, we're always bringing new people in to help with the food pantry. I'm watching a volunteer right now help somebody through this Amazon application. We've had a lot of volunteers who have helped in case management. We've got volunteers who are delivering food bags to people who don't have cars and we don't want them to ride public transportation. So there are a lot of things that volunteers can do.
Well, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, great talking with you. Thank you.
And thank you for your time and all this information.
You're welcome, Binay.
And good luck.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Good luck to you, too.
I thought I'd share a few facts and figures with you based on a 2019 information fact sheet from the UN refugee agency known as UNHCR. In 2019, there were nearly 26 million refugees worldwide, and only one in every 500 were resettled globally. 29 countries around the world accepted refugees for resettlement from over 60 different countries, and that the top three countries of origin for refugees were Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Myanmar. While the U.S. is considered to have the largest resettlement program in the world, it is Turkey, Pakistan, and Uganda that were the top three host countries for refugees in 2019. And one final fact is that in 1980, the U.S. resettled over 200,000 refugees, whereas in 2019, only about 30,000. Of those 30,000, 54% were from Africa, 17% from Asia, 17% from Europe, 9% from the Near East and South Asia, and 3% from Latin America and the Caribbean. Some numbers to think about. Today's show was the 10th in a series of 10 episodes for The Process. I have accomplished my goal of completing my first ever series of podcasts. It's been a wonderful experience talking to so many people about how they got to where they are and do what they do. Everyone has their own journey, yet, tous les chemins mènent à Rome. All roads lead to Rome. There is no one way. I hope you found these interviews as insightful and interesting as I did, and that you've been able to take away some good nuggets for your own journey. If you liked the program, be sure to like it on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, Spotify, or The Process Facebook page. And don't forget to check out the whus.org website to see pictures of all of my guests and find out a little bit more about them. As always, I thank WHUS Stores for helping me make The Process. What a great resource college radio stations are for people like you and me. If you want to do your own podcast, find out about training at your local college radio station. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to The Process. Until next time, ta-ta!